Welcome to Higher Exchanges. It's episode 23. It's Michael Jordan's number, and I'm your host, Jesse Redmond, Managing Director at Water Tower Research, where I cover the cannabis sector. The boys are back, and we have two special guests this week. First, the regulars. He's Mayor Toby on Twitter. He's Tier 1 in Select Tier 2's Toby to me. Toby, how are you today?
I'm good, Jesse. How are you?
I am doing well, thank you. And he's the artist, formerly known as Hedgie Vestude. He's the co-founder and managing director at Poseidon Investment Management. He's Morgan Paxia. Morgan, how are you?
The boys are back in town.
Yes.
Doing good. Yeah, excited to be back here this week. It's been a lot going on, so excited to be back. Back on with everybody here.
And guys, I'm not here to shame Twitter handles. My old one was Green Giants, and I changed it to my actual name. What was that, about a year or so ago? So we all evolve, so don't take my jokes as Twitter handle shaming. I have evolved as well.
Are they? Is it proper now to say they're X handles?
Yeah, I think. What would the name be? I don't know. Did someone take over Hedgie Vestude? That's a question.
Oh. Well, that's a good question too. Yeah, no, like you, I migrated off the Hedgie Vestude and went to the full name. But I was just curious, what is a proper naming function to say to reference someone's handles, since we're supposed to shed the Twitter?
I know someone on X that would know that, Morgan. His name is Grok.
Oh, I'm grokking it.
All right, you grok it. I'm going to keep rolling. Okay, guys, and in about 20 minutes, we'll be joined by Jason Wild and Ziad Ghanem of TerrAscend. But let's kick things off in the top, talking about where Toby was last week. Toby, you hail from parts unknown in Southern California, and you migrated an unknown distance away to the Roth Conference, which is at Laguna Beach, Laguna Niguel, something like that, Toby?
Dana Point, but okay. Very close.
Lovely, lovely area. Toby, talk a little bit about why you went to the conference, what you saw, what you took from it.
Yeah, sure. And I'm able to talk about the conference because the Roth Cannabis team, which is Scott Fortune and his associate, Nick, allowed me to kind of give some high-level takeaways. And, it's interesting because I've actually been to that conference, can't even count how many years in a row. But I've been going to the conference for, I don't know, maybe about 15 years. It's a growth conference focused on sort of smaller cap and mid-cap stocks. They do it every year in beautiful Dana Point, California, which is in Orange County. And I used to go a lot when I was on the institutional side. Recently I've been just sort of as a, you know, kind of family office investor. The cannabis team over at Roth was nice enough to invite me and got a chance to meet with, kind of different people in the cannabis ecosystem, including some companies, other investors, et cetera. It was a pretty good conference. I'll just share kind of some very high level, takeaways from it. But, you know, I think that I've been going to this conference for a while, and to me, one of the biggest sort of striking points was that there's just a dichotomy between where the sector is now and, you know, sort of where it was a few years ago. And I say that, I use the word dichotomy because I think we all know that cannabis, it's been sort of a hype. It can be a hype sector, right? And there's boom and bust cycles. And, I would say that in 2019, I went to the same conference and they had a pretty big cannabis, presence, at the conference. I'm going to say that they had, basically panels running throughout the entire day. There were countless companies there. I couldn't even count how many investors. It was sort of, a little bit of a euphoria. One of the biggest companies at the conference at the time was MedMen. And I remember, going into the MedMen presentation, and I've met with the management team there before. And it's funny, actually, the old CEO there actually, one of his, when they did their IPO, effective IPO, they actually brought them through my office when I was in San Francisco at the time. But anyways, long story short, you know, a few years ago, you know, in 2019, I mean, this conference, the cannabis section was jam packed. And you know, you had companies like MedMen, you had a ton of smaller companies, you had Canadian companies. It was pretty crazy. There was a lot of hype. There was a lot of excitement. And, you know, I think it just says something when a company like MedMen was basically the largest company, at the conference, and everybody was talking about it. And I can't help but feel like this year, you know, and I massively respect Roth and the work that they do. But, you know, candidly, I think as we all know, you know, we're still in the phase where we're building institutional interest in the sector. And candidly, it was obviously a lot more toned down this year. There were a lot less companies, a lot less investors. And I use the word dichotomy because it's just so crazy because in 2019, a lot of these stocks in the sector, you know, we just kind of come off like the Canadian legalization. There's a lot of hype about some of these, I call them kind of the first generation US companies. And, you know, I know Morgan and Jesse, you probably are a lot more familiar with them than I am. But, you know, there's a lot of hype around these sort of Gen 1 companies like MedMen and Ianthus. And, you know, honestly, I can't even name the rest of them because I don't remember. What it turned out to be is these companies weren't building sustainable businesses. There was a lot of fake business models. There was a lot of super fancy, you know, charts and investment slide decks projecting massive TAMs and, you know, strong unit economics, like, you know, our Beverly Hills store does $50 million a year and blah, 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 right? So I'm kind of making those numbers up. But suffice it to say, in 2019, there was a lot of investor interest. There was definitely a ton of hype. And the industry was so much more, it was not as mature as it is today. And not to say that today they're super mature, you know, because I still think that these are emerging businesses. But, you know, fast forward to today, and I would say that it's almost the complete opposite. You know, you have a sector that has grown substantially to $30 billion of legal sales. You have, you know, you have companies, you have, call it four companies that are doing $1 billion plus in revenue and are profitable. And you have a ton of smaller companies, but, you know, sort of behind them that are also have pretty strong business models and, you know, pretty strong and sound growth strategies and also just superior management teams to, you know, the companies from the 20, you know, the previous era. And yet the investor interest is just a fraction of what it was, in my opinion. And, you know, we all kind of know the reasons why, but I just can't help but feel, you know, it was just kind of, it was expected, but it's just interesting to see it again, like to see sort of the, I don't want to say lack of investor interest, but it's candidly, it is a little bit of a lack of investor interest, despite where the industry is today. And, you know, again, I just think it's an interesting dichotomy. You know, obviously, I think, you know, I guess in a nutshell, I'll say in 2019, there was a lot of hype and it turned out most of the companies were fake, right? A lot of the companies were fake. And you fast forward today and I think there's real companies and there's just still very little investor interest. And the last thing I'll say about that is, you know, obviously overlaying all of this is that today we are, in my personal opinion, and it's just my opinion, we are so much closer to actual federal reform than we obviously were in 2019. So, you know, I think it just, I think cannabis continues to be, in my opinion, the ultimate contrarian sector. You know, but again, we have to see the right catalyst play out. So yeah, I'll just kind of pause there and see if you guys want to kind of hear anything else about the conference.
Yeah, I think the institutional interest is an interesting point. Institutional interesting. My observation: I track closely all the things that I publish and all of the interviews that I do, and track the readership and the listenership of those things. And my observation, Toby, is that you have the same group which is kind of the core audience, and their interest does fluctuate. Where, you know, my readership has gotten up as high as a 90% open rate on our email list, which is, you know, crazy high for significant email lists. And then it can also dip down to 60%, depending on what's going on in the sector. Usually just sentiment around stock prices. Sometimes it's around the content that I'm publishing. Some names are more popular than others. But generally, it's just an indicator of sentiment in the space. And right now, despite the higher stock prices, the audience is not particularly engaged. We see that on Twitter. If you just look at the impressions of your tweets over time, mine are kind of right now in the middle of the normal range, despite it feeling like there's a lot of cool stuff going on. So I think point number one is we have the core group, and their interest in the space fluctuates, largely driven by stock prices and largely driven by political rumors, which are so highly correlated to stock prices. I think point number two is you do have, I believe you do have increasing institutional interest, but they're early in doing the work. And what I hear is a reticence to spend resources, because what if you assign a PM or an analyst to it? They fly out to a bunch of conferences. They spend a portion of their day learning about these stocks. And then you land on schedule two or you land on schedule one. And according to our Twitter audience, 2/3 of them say they would not continue investing in the space if we land anywhere but schedule three or better. So basically with 280E still in place, most people that are in the committed audience here would say they would move on from investing in cannabis. I think the others would probably get much more selective in what they're doing in cannabis. And I think if you're an institution looking at this space, you need Schedule 3 in order for them to probably really consider it an interesting opportunity and to start that chain of political progress. You know, that could ultimately lead to things like SAFER, things like Garland memos, things like descheduling or rescheduling, and things like uplisting, which are all the path to unlock a lot of value from these stocks. So I'm not surprised, Toby, to not see the institutions there. I've sensed that at the conferences I've been to in the last few months. Mildly more interest. I have phone calls with more institutions than before. But again, I think it goes back to that point where they say, how do we play the game if we don't know what the rules are going to be? Unless you're a real catalyst guy, you probably are not willing to take that, you know, fairly binary risk about getting Schedule 3 or not. And, you know, I think if we land on Schedule 3, I'd be curious what that conference looks like next year, or what any conference looks like months after we land on Schedule 3. Will that in fact bring the institutions in? Morgan, Toby, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other part of that is, oh, by the way, X handle is the proper
X handle, okay,
nomenclature per Grok. I think the other piece to that is companies are responding the same way. To you know, Jesse, you're noting this, but just, you know, kind of double clicking on it, so to speak, for a moment is, you know, you think, and Toby, I'd be curious to hear this too, but it's like the amount of companies participating has also declined massively. Because they also know that there's just not the investors there that they want to be meeting with. So, you know, there still are some, but it's not like it was. I mean, to your point, back in the good old days when it was frothy central and there was a bunch of, you know, insanity going on, but there was just a lot of companies. So you could actually still sit down with, like, GTIs of the world would be there and you could meet with them and, you know, get, you know, time with them, which, you know, they really have not been active in a lot of events for a long time because the investors that they want to meet with, again, are just not present because they're just not as active in the meantime. And that's why I think we asked Boris, and curious to hear the update from JW here in a bit, as, you know, being listed companies now, you know, how their conversations are going around institutional interest, because at least it's a little bit of an easier hurdle with that. But Toby, yeah, just kind of curious to hear from the more of like the supply side of the event. What did you think from that perspective?
Yeah, you know, there were a decent number of companies in attendance, but I got to, you know, kind of echoing what Jesse said, I completely agree with that. I think institutions are looking, you know, the ones that are starting to do the work are, you know, and sharpening their pencils. Obviously, they need more, they need more clarity. And I think one thing that I've kind of consistently heard is, you know, if the thesis pans out, these stocks have a significant, you know, amount of upside, especially the top ones. And we don't need to be first. like we need to figure out where things are. And they're, you know, I cut, you know, we always joke about it. And I know it's like, it sounds dumb or silly to say now, but it is true. Like the buyers are higher. And I firmly believe like, you know, there's going to be more when MSOS, just using it as a proxy for the sector, if it's at 15 or whatever it is, like 15 or 20, I mean, you're going to get more people interested then, right? You know, just kind of pointing out another obvious point as far as the institutions go is these stocks are just not, you know, accessible. Obviously, you know, if you could even get your compliance department to okay, you know, approve you buying some of these companies, they barely trade. Curaleaf last week, I think it was last Thursday, the largest cannabis company in the world by revenue and market cap, you know, 4 billion-ish market cap, traded $1 million, like on both the, you know, TSX and the OTC. So how do you even put money to work? And so, you know, it's, we always kind of talk about this, but there it's literally just not accessible, which is why, you know, at some point we're going to need to see uplisting. But it's always, you know, and I mentioned this on my spaces yesterday with Mitch at Merida. I really do think, you know, there's going to be, if we get the right set of catalysts, there's going to be companies doing equity raises at higher prices. And, I think that's kind of a win-win for a lot of people. If, you know, using that, the equity raise is a way to get larger investors into your stock because they couldn't, you know, sort of buy the stock in the open market otherwise. So yeah, it's, you know, this is still, it's still, it's like on the one hand, it's still, you know, there's still a lot of unknowns. It's still an early, you know, kind of emerging market sector. But then on the other hand, we now have, you know, a handful of companies doing $1 billion plus of revenue and for the most part, profitable.
You know, the other thing, just real quick, back then, almost all the companies there were growing 100% plus. So, you know, and I know we've talked about this too, but maybe a little bit harder to get some people excited about single digit growth. I know we have our guests joining that had a nice 28% year over year growth. So still showing good to strong growth, especially relative to so many others in the space. But, you know, back then it was, even though the quality of that growth was not even real, but they still were putting up those numbers. And I think people, that was exciting, right? There was definitely an excitement around that kind of growth that just was feeding that frothiness. So.
Yeah, Ziad, the last point I'll just make about how early we are in this sector is, while Ziad's connecting, the last point I'll make is, I mean, look, this is true. Like this is, I've been joking around with people about this. Like if you look at the MSOS, the highest price year to date was based on, you know, an attorney posting a rumor on LinkedIn. I mean, this is where we are in the sector. So anyways, yeah, that's all I'll say.
Jason, I just sent you an invite. So if you see that there, grab it. If not, feel free to hit request to speak and I'll invite you up that way. But in the meantime, we do have Ziad Ghanem. Ziad, how are you? You might be on mute there, my friend.
I still see him as spinning, connecting. Do you see that?
No, I see him as a speaker. Can you hear us there, Ziad?
Come on, Ziad.
You can do it. Oh, let me try accepting it again here. And Jason, like I said, I sent you an invite, so you might see that. If you don't see it, feel free to request and I'll bring you up. Oh, these guys, well, we wrestle with the technology. Morgan, I was just on that Cannabis Investing Network podcast, and on there I talked about some different ways to win in California. Do you have any big top-down views? I know you're obviously in California, you make investments here. Do you have any big top-down views about ways to win or what kind of necessary ingredients to succeed in California?
I think it's pretty fundamental. Good verticality, good retail. Managing costs insanely because it's so easy to overspend in California with it being just an expensive state to do business generally, and in cannabis, real estate's expensive, everything's expensive here. So, you know, but yeah, if you can build and get scale with the best balance sheet you possibly can do to keep your costs, your interest expense low, you know, so it's just kind of the same idea. And, you know, I'd love to hear what hopefully these guys are able to connect, but you know, similar to how they're approaching, take Michigan, for example, right, where you have incredibly low pricing. Obviously, the cost side is a little bit more favorable there, but you still you know, building a scaled operation to absorb that overhead as much as you can, I think is just a good recipe. And up to this point, I don't think many have done that without blowing up their balance sheets. So that's why you just haven't seen many success stories, regardless of how much people love to rag on it. It's like, you know, ranks number two to New York in that regard. But yeah, no, I still think it's, you know, similar approach as it is in these other markets, just with even more discipline. And yeah, you have to be even more strong on execution, because it's competitive, not just within the legal market, but with a very strong illicit market.
Jason Zia, did we finally get down here?
Okay. Yeah, hi.
Yes, hello everyone.
Hey Zia, hey Jason, welcome. Before we get into the quarter, guys, as we're rounding out the California conversation, any thoughts, Jason, on the necessary ingredients to win in California, or how the state is going for you guys at this point?
The necessary what? I'm sorry.
Necessary ingredients to win in California.
Ingredients to win in California. I mean, I think it's the same as, you know, winning in, probably very similar to winning in Michigan. I think I heard you guys just saying that it was similar. I mean, you have to be able to cope with, you know, sort of, especially in California, you know, it's a more expensive place to operate. You know, and the growth is not the same, and it's more competitive. So the only way to do it is, you know, to if you could be lean, you know?
Yeah. Yep. Well, great. Well, why don't we kind of take a step back and reframe things a little bit. You guys just reported the fourth quarter last week, Jason. Listened to the call, did some analysis, but why don't I turn it over to you guys, and if you just want to give an overview of what you think were the highlights of the quarter.
Sure, see? You want to do that?
Yeah, I'd love to. So, you know, I think we reported the quarter and the year. So if you allow me just to highlight the combination between the two, you know, 2023, all four quarters were fundamentals for us. We've done, the team has done an outstanding job traveling a long distance and really setting the fundamentals in a way that that made me super proud. You look at our revenue for the year grew 28%, which led the industry. Our gross margin improved from 41% in 2022 to 50.3% for 2023. Our adjusted EBITDA in 2023 improved by 77% year over year. EBITDA margin improved from mid-teens to low 20s 2023 over 2022. So that's from a P&L perspective. From a balance sheet perspective, we reduced our debt by 40%, reduced our interest by almost that much. We uplisted on the TSX. We entered Maryland. So when I tallied and inventoried the accomplishments that the team at TerrAscend has done, really I could describe this year as one of the most unique and smiley year I've had. So in a very tough environment, in Q4, in the fourth quarter, we had our margin was where we expected to be, minus around 1.5 to 2 full points due to a one-time event that we described in Maryland. In Q4, we were talking about Michigan. We promised that we will get to low 40% in gross margin in Michigan compared to Q2, where it was at low 20s. So just less than a year ago, gross margin in Michigan was 22%, and we improved it to 29%, then the following quarter to 36%. That was Q3, we announced 40% in Q4. So again, we proved that even in state that is pretty mature, when you get to this level, you'll be able to add scale, and with scale and efficient operation, you'll be able to create profit, and that's the play in Michigan. Jason, what did I leave? What would you like to add? I'm sure I left tons.
No, I think you covered most of it. You know, the TSX listing, the, you know, we could even discuss the TSX listing a little bit more later, in terms of, you know, what we think was successful about it, and, you know, what wasn't, but that, and just, you know, the I'm proud that we were actively, you know, reducing our leverage. You know, that we did it. We got started early, and that also helped us position us for the success that we had last year. And you know, especially from a cash flow perspective, it's, you know, we saved a lot of interest.
Yeah, and Jesse, I feel that I answered your question fully for the year, but they didn't do any justice for the quarter. Mm-hmm. From a revenue perspective, in the quarter, we had a 25.5% increase year over year. Our gross margin was 48.2% versus 44.6% same quarter last year. Adjusted EBITDA increased by 60.7%. So similar numbers on the quarter year over year versus the entire year. But I just wanted to make sure that that I'll mention those for the quarter as well.
Yep, yep. And I guess the news at the end of when we just reported about the that we were filing the amended returns and you know and that news, I guess that's newish as well.
Yep.
And you know, and we're going to treat it as a normal taxpayer going forward. But I think the one thing is for the fourth quarter that I'm proud of there is that we did cover even our tax payments if they were calculated mm-hmm. in the way that we think is not legal. We would have covered that and still been slightly cash flow positive. So you know that felt good as well.
Yeah, lots of positives for the whole year. You know, big things, you know, that we've talked about, you know, all of last year were the TSX, the improvements to the balance sheet. And I really liked our conversation over the summer about getting the four stores in Maryland. And seems like that turned out really well. Generally strong on the cultivation side, but I did want to bring up the issue there that you guys did have in the fourth quarter. Anyone that follows me on X, I didn't say Twitter, I said X, they will know that I grow mediocre flower in my backyard every year. Mm-hmm. And last year, the gophers towards the end pulled them down and I lost most of my crop to gophers. I doubt that's the issue you had in Maryland, Jason, but I do understand that things do come up. Can you talk a little bit about what happened in Maryland? Be as specific as you want, and maybe just more importantly, what you took from it, what you learned from it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, do you want to take that? Or I mean, I'll start it off and then I can turn it over to you. You
sure.
Know, whatever you like. I mean, the fact is that we're using all new equipment in Maryland and not, and, you know, all of our people in the Northeast, they're, you know, like they've used the different lights and other equipment. And we just had some issues around that, you know, stuff that's, you know, that's remedied since. Yeah, what would you add to that?
The only thing I would add is I'll put timestamp around it. Before we improved the SOPs, before we took the learnings, we went to bed on one evening and we came back the second morning and the harvest was not happy at all and was dark and semi burned. And we made the quick decision to get out of it, and then that resulted in a lot of discounts that we described on the earnings call. Since then, we have had a new harvest that came in and checked every metric we have for our brand standards, from flower profile to yield to terpene and THC level, the nose. So really, we learned a lot from it, and we adjusted and trained and changed the SOP, and I'm proud of the Maryland team. It's a delicate flower, and she does not like rapid changes. And even when you are when you have a reputation of your quality, you can make mistakes, and she'll let you know.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, sometimes we see people saying things on Twitter like weed is so easy to grow. Once everyone has access to it, they'll just jump to this jump. And it's like, hey man, have you actually grown a plant before? Because that's not at all how this works.
Totally. Yes. Maybe 30 years ago, you know, like when you would like, you know, separate out all the seeds and stuff like that. But nowadays, I mean, you know, we've all talked about this, I think, ad nauseum about how consumers expect more and more, like practically every month, because everybody's like dialing it in. You know, if what we're growing is doesn't meet those standards, we're not gonna, you know, do anything to endanger the brand by trying to sell it as regular flour. We'll sell it as biomass or put it through extraction or something like that. But, you know, but that stuff costs money too.
Well, I mean, you guys have experience with that, so it seems like you've already remedied it from the call I was listening to. It seems like you guys are already back on track and it's hitting target to above target. So, you know, which is great to hear. But one of the things I wanted to chat about a bit was, you know, we are hearing from a lot of companies about the wholesale strength, right? And I know you guys had some really nice wholesale strength in like New Jersey, obviously putting aside that other matter. I was just kind of curious, you know, how you guys think about it. Cause like, you know, JW, we've seen this enough over the years where when there's high prices and wholesale demand, a lot of people turn on and we're hearing a lot of turning on. So how do you think about that from like a dynamic planning perspective, you know, is and like managing the supply? So I did hear a little bit of that conversation about like grow room management, lighting them on, turning them off, but you know, it just kind of curious if you had anything you wanted to share on that and Zach too.
I'll do maybe the 10,000 foot view or so. I think that it's, I think we've all expected more competition to come as it relates to places like Jersey. Like we would have expected that it had already come to more of an extent than it has. We're constantly sort of, well, the biggest thing you have to do is just keep producing the best flour you can, because that's the best thing that's going to retain your market share with the least pressure on pricing. But I would say overall, there hasn't been a huge amount of capacity that is that's come online. There's certainly been more retail stores that have come online, and that's helped make up for you know, for any losses we have from our own retails that were obviously we weren't expecting a. Those to stay at the rates they were, you know, those the first year or so. So I don't know. That's the way we look at it. We've had all our rooms. I mean, we're going full steam out of Jersey. We could supply more, I think, more on the manufactured product side. But that's really Ziad's wheelhouse. So feel free to jump in, Z.
Yeah, I'll just expand it a little bit. You know, you talked, Jason, about New Jersey. I'll add even Pennsylvania. You know, we celebrated in Pennsylvania, a state that is, the market is not growing. It's flattish or so. We have grown our retail quarter of the, over the quarter for the last 2 quarters, year over year as well, both on retail and wholesale. You know, same story in Maryland. So you have three markets in different stages. And if I step back, if I step back and I think what makes wholesale successful, you're right, there's the supply and demand. But with what I described, you know, wholesale is in our DNA. We started, it's not something new that we're doing. We started years ago in Pennsylvania. We proved that we can do it when it started in Pennsylvania, then New Jersey, then Maryland. And in my opinion, there are two buckets for success, two recipes for success in wholesale. The first one, everybody can do or everybody can acquire, and it's not hard at all. And that is the ground game. It's the selling, it's the distribution points, the supply chain. It's managing the order size, is responding. It's just treating the end consumer through a middle customers with white glove and occupy the shelves. So that is something that could be done by anybody who is not an expert in cannabis. But where our team excelled the most is the second part, and that is to sustain wholesale, to create the velocity, and to have repetition on the orders. You need quality, you need brand, you need portfolio variety, and ongoing innovation, creating that excitement, that consumer pull. And we have those on those two buckets. And I believe that is what's making us successful and will allow us to continue to be successful in that space.
Very interesting. Yeah, quality is obviously very important. I know you guys focus on that quite a bit. You know, another thing I thought was really interesting from the call and marketing, you know, the IR deck was a conversation around M&A. And, you know, one thing I think the world should listen to is, you know, was when TerrAscend says they're going to do something, they have a track record of doing it, right? So, you know, just the amount of things you accomplished last year. But, you know, you were pretty notable on certain markets you want to go into, and you know, potentially something of size, which got all of our minds percolating here at Poseidon. But just kind of curious if there was more you wanted to talk about. I know you can't, nothing specific, but you know, any insights around strategy or consideration there, and just understanding the market dynamics.
Yep. So you want to start that?
Yeah, I would love to. I think you said something very accurate. Is when Jason decides or give a vision on something, he's pretty stubborn about it. And you know, him and I were talking last night, and one of us was reading on an adjective on how leadership is, and we came up with a word. Jason, what's the word that we discussed?
I don't remember. Which word?
Yeah, it's the word then when you think of an idea that we don't think it's possible, and then you prove to the world that it is possible.
Self-fulfilling prophecy or something?
Yeah, no, I'll pull it in a second. It's okay. But I guess my point is, we are a company that was formed through acquisition, right? We brought 3 or 4 acquisitions together. And what we focused on in 2023 is to really nail the operation, strengthen the fundamentals. And we've done this in the 5 states that we are in. We believe now is the time for us to focus on the expansion. We believe that we have significant greenfield opportunities ahead of us. You know, we declared prior to Maryland going rec that we will be in Maryland. And on our call last week, we said that we will be in Ohio before adult use launch. And we felt confident because of some of the conversations we've had, because of the importance of Ohio, the size of Ohio. And Ohio also fits in our Midwest region, right? From a regional structure, we can better leverage Michigan with similar to the way we manage the Northeast and bring scale to an efficient team. Now, so that's what we announced from a state perspective, but we hinted, and we can't share more on transformational deals. You know we have our focused footprints. We built a decent reputation on our operational excellence. We have the right sponsorship. There are a lot of opportunities out there that complement our footprint in a very effective way. And this all has led to the opportunities that we alluded to when we talked about it. So wish we could share more, but I would put it in a
soon.
Bucket.
Yeah, imminent. Yeah. Soon.
Yeah, imminent.
Yeah. Hey, yeah, it's not the government. It's not the government imminent. It's soon. Yes.
Yeah.
In the days ahead, as some would say.
Yeah, in the days ahead.
Yeah, I guess. Hey, Jason. Hey, Ziad. Yeah, you know, I guess. Yeah, I mean, you guys are obviously a pretty active, have been active acquirers. You know, this is something that I'm kind of wondering because, you know, I chatted with a bunch of other companies as well. And, you know, people's acquisition pipelines are still obviously, you know, the last kind of year or so we've seen a slowdown in M&A. But can you just walk us through like the psychology from the sort of seller's perspective? I mean, on the one hand, you know, I feel like we're on the cusp of, you know, potential reform and equity values would go up, et cetera. So I kind of question, like, why would someone sell now versus waiting for the reform? But also, you know, I also think there's a lot of companies that realize increasingly, obviously, they need to find a home within a larger company. And they're looking at, you know, who's the best partner for that, et cetera. So just like, what's behind the seller psychology, especially right now on the cusp of potential, you know, reform?
Yep. So yeah, you want to start that?
But Toby, allow me to remember it's Shapers, Jason. The Principle Life and Work, and how taking visualization to actualization and right. Yeah. But all right. So sellers, I think the main reason is it's scale. Really, it's scale. Whether you could leverage the scale of northeast versus one state, of one state versus five stores, of five stores versus one store. And that is where, in my opinion, the sector is maturing in a nice way. Like the being drunk with the small operators or the of the independents that come in and say, all right, I want to open one store and I want to compete. It's much, much harder without the scale. And that's what we are seeing. And I think, Toby, the way we're structuring some of those deals, because of our stock acting like a currency, and because of what's coming in from a reform perspective, from a rescheduling perspective, from a rebound that the industry is anticipating, and I believe in, and I fully believe in a different way than the previous 2 or 3 years. A currency that eventually could pay you 1.5, 2 times more, or 20%, 30%, 40% more than when you made the deal, and that happened for us in Maryland for the seller. I think that's what the psyche of the seller is in, and some of them would like to be involved. Some of them would like to get earnouts and participate, but they can benefit from scale. Jason, anything else you're seeing?
No, that's right. And I just think that you guys hear me? You hear me? Hello?
Yes. Yep.
Hello?
You hear me? Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, great. Okay, good. I think also like a lot of these acquisitions like that we think are available and that we know are available, they're at super low multiples, but they're not insignificant amounts of money for the sellers. So, like, if there's, you know, and we're looking at a lot of sort of, like, you know, best in class in our view, mom and pops in certain states, and whatever we'd be paying them, again, while it would be, you know, we think, you know, very low multiple and very accretive relative to our multiple, like, for the targets, like, they've built a very successful business. They didn't raise as much money as a lot of these other companies have. So if they... whatever amount of money they take down, and even if it's not all cash and some of it's in stock, they look at it like they're, you know, trading in their stock in a single state operator, which obviously has more risk, you know, for stock in a more diversified, operator that does have the benefit of scale, and they look at that as, you know, a de-risking event for them.
Yep. Can you say, like, I mean, I can't speak for any sellers, but can you say whether or not, you know, their excitement about taking the stock? I mean, it just seems like if I built a company, you know, two stores in Ohio, I personally wouldn't want to cash out right now. So I would obviously, you know, obviously it's like a liquidity event, but it's not really, right? It's like I'm upgrading my stock and I'm not going to go public because I only have two stores.
Right.
So I want to go public. So I want stock in a public company. Is that, are they more excited to take the stock or the cash?
I mean, I think generally, you know, if we had more cash, we could use more cash and you get even better, you know, value for that. But the good news is if we went all the way to the other end of the spectrum and used 100% stock, it's still, you know, in our view, you know, these deals are very, very, you know, wildly accretive. So, and then it's usually like some combination, like it might be, you know, we need X amount, some small percentage in cash up front. You can also structure, like in a couple of the Maryland deals, we can also structure it where it's a seller note. So at least it's cash instead of stock, but it's cash, you know, over time at a reasonable interest rate, you know, versus stock.
Got it. It makes
so
sense.
We can be flexible with all that or structure it like an earnout, like what we did with Pennsylvania with Ilera years ago was, we paid them, it was like a maximum deal value, I believe, of like $225. We paid up front, though, only $25 in cash and $25 in stock. And then I think the vast majority of the rest of the money was an earnout. It was like a true-up based upon our first year of ownership. So those are really good, too, because it, like, you know, finances the acquisition for you. And then if it goes well, like, you know, Ilera was doing extremely well, you know, for the first few years. Like, we were able to sort of... partly pay the sellers with their own money. So, but it's good because the sellers wanted all cash. They got all cash. They just had to wait, you know, they just had to wait for, you know, a year and a half for, you know, a big percentage of it.
Right, right.
We're flexible.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Look, kind of switching topics a little bit. I want to talk about the tax strategy. I mean, obviously it was, it became a key theme from this recent, you know, earnings round of earnings calls. And obviously Trulieve kind of kicked it off by surprising everyone with a, you know, pretty massive, over $100 million refund. And then we subsequently, it seemed like as earnings season progressed, like companies had sort of more definitive answers as far as the tax strategy. So I think you guys have indicated you're filing for the refunds and you are no longer going to be paying 280E, federal 280E going forward. It's going to be sort of sectioned off. It will be put on your balance sheet as an uncertain tax position, but you're no longer paying it. I guess the question I have is just like, can you give us a little bit more color into the rationale? Because I've talked to a lot of the companies, I've talked to other investors, I've talked to nothing's like super clear, and it's definitely a little bit opaque. But you know, obviously there's some risk in the strategy, but it does seem like it could pay off. So just can you walk us through sort of the thinking behind all this?
Yeah, sure. Sure. Ziad, why don't you start? Because I'm just getting in my car and I'm worried that my phone might break up for a few seconds.
Yeah, Toby, I can start. And I'm going to break it down as much as possible. I see a lot of faces here on in the audience that have done a lot of work and has led a lot of efforts around 280E with the boys lawsuit. I know Jason and so many others have collaborated on this. But I'll try to break it down. And look, Jason and I have asked Lynn, our chief legal officer, to share our strategy with every company that called us and everybody who asked us. I said, call Lynn and she'll give you the name of the law firm. She'll give you exactly what we've done step by step, because it is the tide that lifts all boats. There's no advantage in keeping that secret. This industry, it's disappointing to me. It's disappointing to me when, as hard as it is, us as an industry in an honest, competitive way, we don't come together to help this industry. So I'll try my best, but I'll volunteer here, Lynn, our CLO, to share step by step every thing we've done for every company to do the same. And I am, and bear with me here, I'm passionate about this. I personally am aware of at least 7 or 8 companies that came to Jason and myself, and Lynn shared with them those steps. So anybody on the call who's interested, shoot me an email, and I'd love to do the same. But look, this evaluation started over a year ago, based on legal interpretation. The underpinnings of the legal interpretation are similar to the Boies Schiller case. And I'll let Jason Sagan speak about this because that's his baby. But based on that legal opinion, we changed our position as it relates to the 280E. We are preparing, as we said, to file the amended return for 2020, 2021, and 2022. We have reclassified $59 million to uncertain tax position. We expect around $26 million of refunds that are related to that 2020 and 2021. We have only $4.8 million of current tax income tax liability as of year end, and we plan to make all future payments as an ordinary taxpayer. And all this is based on a legal interpretation, which we have at least 2 shots at goal to make this happen. And the third one, while we don't have under our own control, rescheduling can get us there. So those are the reasons. Jason, if you want to talk a little bit about any of that.
Yeah, I think you covered most of it. It's a lot of the same arguments as the Boies Schiller case. The legal opinions cite a lot of those same arguments as the Boies Schiller case, and I think even cite the Boies Schiller case. And you know, when we look at the different ways to potential tax relief for this industry, rescheduling, obviously that would be great. It seems like that could help have 280E not apply going forward, but that's not going to get us our money back. And the Boies case If we win, we're told that that's a very short walk across the street to the IRS tax court to get our money back. But this as well, you know, this is the other route to that. And, you know, we're glad that that there was that the Trulieve case or not the Trulieve case, but that the Trulieve situation came to light. Because we saw that, you know, that they got their refund. I mean, that's we don't know. Nobody knows exactly what that means, but it's certainly not a negative. You know, we expect ours. We expect ours as well.
Yeah, and we had Boris on a couple weeks ago, like right after the Curaleaf Ernie's call, and his comments were sort of, you know, he basically said, look, he laid out sort of that it was a calculated risk. There is some risk to it, but there's, you know, he thought the upside was multiples of the downside. And his comment was, you know, it's like, we got to force this issue. We as an industry need to force this issue. So are you in complete kind of agreement with all that?
Yes, 100%. Yep.
Okay. Yep. Okay. Thanks.
Gentlemen, we're almost up on our time here, but if I can ask one more big question and hope for a quick answer, which doesn't sound like a fair proposition, but we'll go for it anyway. You guys have been great at capitalizing on adult use flips. You guys did an excellent job in New Jersey and then got the 4 stores in Maryland last year. On the horizon, we have a few states, Pennsylvania, you're well situated. Ohio is an opportunity for you, and so is Florida. Can you talk specifically about Ohio and Florida and any potential plans you have there to capitalize if and when those, or I guess, you know, Ohio has gone adult use, but Florida potentially going adult use?
Yeah, you're gonna get Ziad very excited. I know you're chopping at the bits, Hanson.
Hey, we're interested in both, and we will be ready for both. Hopefully, that's the short answer.
Yes, but we like Florida.
Man. Come on.
We like Florida.
Hey, I thought you said it's big with short. Look, with Ohio, we are having multiple conversations, and there are multiple ways where we can enter Ohio. Now it's a matter of. Is it in a big way or a bigger way? And I mean it. And I wish I could share more with you, Jesse. But it's important to us. It's part of our Midwest, and it makes sense. And it doesn't make sense for us not to be there. And like we said on the call, take it as the same announcement we did for Maryland. We will be in Ohio by adult use the same way we promised we'll be by Maryland. And this is not without. Detail thinking and detail conversation and how we get there.
Yep. And how about Florida?
And as far as Florida, look, a week from today is when the Supreme Court has to give their verdict, whether it's on the ballot or not.
Yep.
If it's on the ballot, we know when the elections is. We know when. We know that it needs 60%. Both Jason and I are Florida residents, and we will plan to vote. And we know that the votes are there. There are good, attractive assets in Florida. We believe that states like Florida makes sense to enter in a sizable manner, not to build from scratch. And that's the strategy there.
Well, great. Anything else, Jason, before we wrap?
No. I mean, we like both of those states, and there's some other ones, some other ones as well. But I wouldn't add anything more.
Okay. Well, great. We always appreciate you guys joining us. Thanks for being here today. And if and when there's more to talk about on Ohio or otherwise, I'd love to have you back on.
Our pleasure. Great. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye, everyone. Thank you.
All righty. We have 4 minutes left, and we do need to wind this up at 2:00 Pacific today. But it is time for everybody's favorite segment of the week. It is time for Morgan Paxia's Ask Grok.
Well, yes, here we go. Well, one, that was a great conversation. I always appreciate hearing from Jason and Ziad. So, but I had an anonymous request this week for my grok question. I thought it was fun. I like to keep these fun. And so the question was, Who, or what is Mayor Toby the mayor of? And so I asked Grok.
Oh my God.
And Grok said I would consider him the mayor of quote unquote Chronicville or quote unquote Weedtopia, as those are names, are a nod to his love for cannabis. It's only fitting for him to be the mayor of a place where the grass is always greener. That is a fun and playful way to acknowledge his passion and and the community he's built around it. So there you go. You are the take your pick, or what do you think, Toby?
Mayor of Chronicle sounds pretty good, man.
Yeah, no, I might have to change. I might have to change my Twitter, my ex profile to that. But I would obviously, I'd happily be a mayor of a fake utopian city than most cities. So, and in my city, cannabis is fully descheduled, decriminalized, and there's definitely no 280E.
Oh wow, you could sell plots of like farmland and retail on the metaverse, and there you go. There's a whole new business model.
Yeah, that's funny. But it is interesting to see Grok kind of it does seem so tied into X, because I think we kind of talked about this on another Grok question, but it seems to be pulling a lot from X, right?
It's all it does, yeah.
Do you have any context on the name Mayor Toby? Did it have any special meaning to you, Toby?
No, it's just, my ex profile, I've been thinking about rebranding it. It's just something that I've had for a really long time, and I don't even know why I created it. And, when I've had an ex account for a long time, but when I got active on Twitter, a few years ago, I just kind of kept it. And I've thought about rebranding. It's kind of cool. I go to conferences and people say, hey, you're the mayor. So, even Don Murphy, the first time I had a space with Don Murphy, I had a call with him kind of beforehand. And he's like, were you actually a mayor? And I said, no, of course not. So, yeah. But, hey, it's cannabis. We're allowed to, we got to have some fun when we can.
That's right.
Yeah, people at my firm refer to you as Mayor first name and Toby last name or something like that. They're yeah, I saw you and Mayor were doing something the other day.
Yeah, and I saw a couple of your colleagues at the conference this week and said hi. So very, very, oh, cool. Yeah, very nice people.
I think Tim and Sean were down there.
Yeah.
Well, all right, guys. Yeah, we're getting against the deadline here. So another good show. Thanks again for Ziad and Jason for joining us. Next week, we'll be back at the usual hour. I'm going to be heading up to Northern California to visit Leaf Brand's extraction facility, and then stopping by Gold Flora in San Jose to visit their grow and some of their stores. So looking forward to that, and happy to chat a bit about that next week. But Morgan, Toby, have a good weekend, and we'll see you guys all on Thursday.
Great. Thank you all.
The views expressed in this podcast may not necessarily reflect the views of Water Tower Research LLC, aka WTR, and are provided for informational purposes only. Higher changes may not be distributed or reproduced without the written consent of Water Tower Research and should not be considered research nor a recommendation. WTR is an investor relations firm, not a licensed broker, broker-dealer, market maker, investment bank, underwriter, or investment advisor. All investing involves risk, including the loss of principal.